Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
Our guest today is Rachel Stinson from Wright, Close & Barger in Houston. You may know her from another friend of the show, Rafi Malkonian, who is one of her law partners. But we have Rachel on here to talk about kind of her different background in practice. So, Rachel, thank you for joining us today. We're really glad you're here.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
So for the people listening who don't know you, can you just kind of tell us a little bit about yourself and your background and how you came to be where you are now?
Sure. So I'm a native Texan. I went to the University of Texas. Like a lot of people, I did not intend to be a lawyer. I have a background in art history. And after graduating from UT, I went to New York for a couple of years to work in an auction house and an art gallery. Doing that, I realized that one, that's not a great way to make a living. And two, I was going to need to go back to school to get a PhD. And in the process of thinking about that, I realized that while running the gallery in the business of art, I had been sort of reading contracts for fun. The insurance policies, the import-export agreements, the mechanics of how art gets shipped around the world from one place to another, what happens when something goes wrong, I found that fascinating. A couple of times my boss even said to me, you know, we want to like sell the art, right? Like you get that, right? Because I found the mechanics of, okay, we need to make sure that we know what we're doing before we send this piece off. And do we have all of our bases covered? The shifting of risk was what I later learned that is, was to me just as fascinating as the art that I was working with. So law school became a possibility. And that's when I decided to start looking around. I had no preconceived notion of what a lawyer was. I'm a first generation lawyer. My dad's an accountant. My mom's an elementary school teacher. And they were the first people in their families with college degrees. So I started looking around and I ended up choosing Georgetown because of the geographic location. It was between New York and Houston. I wasn't quite sure that I was ready to come home. And so DC seemed like the perfect kind of halfway point. And then the opportunity to go to school next to the Supreme Court was just, it turned out to be the best possible place. I had a wonderful experience there. And that sort of snowballed into an interest in appellate law, learning more about it. And I still wasn't quite certain that I wanted to focus on. I honestly didn't even know you could focus on appellate law at the time. But I would come back in summer in Texas and chose a litigation firm. I started at Locke Lord. And this right before my 3L year, I met somebody who had been a clerk at the First Court of Appeals. And again, it's kind of amazing looking back because I kept saying, well, I didn't even know you could do this. Like, I feel like a lot of my career has been a discovery of jobs I didn't know existed at the time and talking to people and saying, oh my gosh, that sounds amazing. Tell me more about that. And thinking, you know, if that opportunity arose, I would do that. And then sure enough, sometimes that opportunity arises. Sometimes it doesn't, but sometimes it does. So I was talking to this person about clerking on the First Court and thought, man, he's just raving about it. I sent an application and ended up getting hired there for a year and was a BA there before I went to Locke Lord. And that's kind of the start of how I learned about appellate law and got interested in it. But for the first 6 years of my practice, I would not have called myself an appellate lawyer. I was definitely interested in it. And it was definitely something that I was trying to learn more about. But it was really hard because you would say, you know, well, I want to do appellate law. Well, yes, so does everybody else. Get in line. And by the way, tell me about your federal appellate clerkship. Oh, well, I don't have one of those. But it was very much a journey of learning about litigation as a whole and the practice as a whole. I wouldn't trade it looking back, but I did definitely feel like everybody keeps talking about this practice, but I don't really know how to switch over to it. So it was just sort of this gradual learning process. Eventually, Judge Hanks, the position of a staff attorney came open. And that's when I left the private practice and went to go work for him at the Court of Appeals. And as I say, from there, it sort of took a life of its own. I thought I was going to work for Judge Hanks for maybe 2 or 3 years, and I ended up working for him for 10 years in the Court of Appeals and then in federal court before I eventually came back to private practice.
And your first experience working for the Court of Appeals, was that with Judge Hanks also? Or
actually, I was hired to be Chief Justice Mike Schneider's briefing attorney, but he ended up getting appointed to the Texas Supreme Court by Rick Perry. So for 6 months, I was kind of the orphan briefing attorney. I got to work for visiting judges. And again, I didn't know how much fun that was going to be. I worked with Frank Price, who was just an absolute gem of a human being. And I learned a ton from him about the Houston legal community and not taking yourself too seriously, taking your work seriously, but not taking yourself too seriously. He would come in and sort of shuffle cards and talk about magic tricks and then talk about the cases. And it was a wonderful way to sort of set the scene of what we were going to talk about was important, but that interpersonal relationship between lawyers was also important. But so anyway, Judge Hanks got appointed, and I only worked for him for about 8 months, but I feel like he packed at least a year's worth of work into those 8 months that I got to work for him. And it was such a great experience that years later, when the chamber's attorney position came open, I applied and was thrilled to be able to go work with him again.
Spend less time analyzing data and more time digging into the facts with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge. Powered by the largest collection of federal and state dockets, litigation analytics instantly aggregates data points to produce information such as likely timeline, outcomes, representation, and damages from which you can base your case strategy and assess potential litigation costs and resources and position yourself for success. Gain a strategic edge using data-driven insights with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge. I know that a lot of courts have changed in the last few years, but how did the first court at the time treat briefing attorneys versus chambers attorneys? Like, what kind of jobs were they?
In my term clerkship, right after law school, the 14th and I think a few other courts had sort of a default where every justice had one briefing attorney and one staff attorney. There were a few other court staff attorneys who tackled various motions, or perhaps they were on a particular docket. But the default was that if you had 9 justices, then you had 18 chambers attorneys, a group of very recent law school graduates that would rotate for a year, and then a group of much more seasoned practitioners from a variety of backgrounds who were kind of the core backbone of the staff. Briefing attorneys tended to take the easier, shorter cases, work very closely with the staff attorneys, and then the judges would supervise both, mentor both. Sometimes the staff attorney would mentor the briefing attorney, but that was varied by chambers by chambers. When I came back as a staff attorney, that was sort of the exception. The first court did still have a number of briefing attorneys, but by that time, it was one of the few places that was still hiring young law school graduates. And I think that's something that's been a little bit of a detriment to Texas practice, that we've gotten away from hiring law school graduates to work in the Court of Appeals. But on the other hand, the workload of the Court of Appeals and the complexity and sophistication of the cases, both criminal cases as well as commercial cases, has gotten to the point where there aren't a lot of cases that you could hand off to a briefing attorney and say, this ought to take you 2 weeks, because those cases are just few and far between.
That was similar to the relationship when I was a law clerk, briefing attorney at the Texas Supreme Court. We pretty much worked first line with the staff attorney, because we sure as new law graduates didn't know how to deal with a Supreme Court case. And so the staff attorneys played played a huge role. I mean, they were essentially the judge's right-hand person. And it meant that you got to develop a really close relationship with those folks too. And I think it says a lot. You wound up going to work for Judge Hanks once the federal appointment came through. And so it says a lot about that relationship that Judge Hanks felt comfortable bringing you over. You see that happen from time to time when usually it's in very close proximity to time that the judge gets the appointment. You know, they take the chamber staff with them And suddenly the newbie has no staff. There was some time in between, or was there not, when Judge Hanks took the federal bench and you went to work with him?
No, I was with him at the Court of Appeals as his staff attorney for about 2 years. And then as soon as he was appointed, I went over to the federal court with him and helped him sort of set up his chambers from day one. And he actually ran his magistrate. He was a magistrate judge first in Houston. And he ran that chambers very similar to the way he had run it on the Court of Appeals. It was a natural sort of segue for us because it was something that we had been used to doing this. As a magistrate judge, you get assigned cases from the district court judges, at least on the civil side. You have a whole different docket on the criminal side, but your civil cases, even though it's not the appellate pipeline, there is a pipeline from your two different source district court judges. So that concept of we have this docket, we have these assignments, we need to track them and have a concept of how long it's taking things to, I always say move through the pipeline, was very much something that was adapted from what we had done at the Court of Appeals and what I had learned from my own mentors at the Court of Appeals.
How was the transition from going to Texas state law appellate court to a federal district court, with federal civil and criminal jurisdiction? How did that process go?
It went surprisingly well. As appellate lawyers or as litigators in general, we're constantly learning new subject matter. At least I was, as a general commercial litigator, sometimes I'd have a real estate case or an insurance case, or, you were constantly learning new vocabulary and new concepts, getting up to speed on the particular case or the needs of your client. And so that skill set translated to going to the magistrate judge chambers. There was a lot of new things to learn, different acronyms, but the general idea was the same. Somebody wants to compel discovery or somebody wants a dispositive motion. Okay, you've got that framework. You learn the law to put on top of that framework. And even though the subject matter, I think we sat down and counted one time of the different types of cases we had. At one point, when we were in Galveston, he would have like 500 new cases filed a year, civil cases. And it was amazing, the subject matter variety of those cases. But the concept, the general framework was always the same, right? I mean, the rules of civil procedure are the same regardless of the subject matter of the case. It's just a matter of keeping up with the acronyms and the new substantive areas that you need to overlay on top of the procedural issues that are going on.
They're both jobs. I mean, both the judge job and the staff attorney job, I would think that have a lot of writing emphasis, both in federal court and in the Court of Appeals.
Yeah, I was surprised. I knew cognitively, because I had practiced in federal court, that federal courts write a lot. They write a ton. They write on everything. And that puts a lot of stress on the chambers. It's just simply what you get used to. But the amount of writing is probably even more than in private practice, because literally that's, you don't worry about clients, you don't worry about getting your time in, or, all of the administrative tasks of private practice. You write, you worry about the docket, and you write. As much as I would like to see more opportunities for new graduates, the pressure of having to write so many cases probably does dictate having chamber staff have a little bit more experience. Or alternatively, I'm a big proponent of people who want a break in their practice. Maybe you've got 5 or 6 years of litigation experience. People applying for term clerkships. It's a pay cut for some people. But the experience of being inside of the mechanics of either an appellate or a trial court chamber to see what happens after the motions are filed, the response, the reply, okay, now chamber staff is going to sit down and go through that. That's a fantastic learning experience.
Suppose in a perfect world, some of that load, that writing load, would be alleviated because of stellar advocacy on both sides in a case. But I suspect that there was more work that went into getting it right than just relying on what the parties told the court the law was and what the parties said the facts were too.
I will say, from my own experience, good writing, it was crucial. It was so helpful. But so was a reputation for being a straight shooter, right? I mean, there were some briefs or motions that were just gorgeous. I mean, they were beautiful and they deserve a whole presentation about, you know, they chose exactly the right word and it was like reading this literary masterpiece. Great. But were they right on the law? Is this, you know, did I feel like after I'd read it that I was really certain that that was the standard of review? Or were those cases where I was like, I don't know that case. Interesting. I'm going to have to look that up. So there is a huge space. And I'm so glad that as a bar, we're talking about effective writing. But I think effective writing is more than just pretty writing. I think there's got to be a component of the judge looking at the attorney signature block and going, oh, good, Jody Sanders is on the case, right? I remember 3 years ago when we had that case and he was honest with me about what was or wasn't in the record. And I'm so glad to see that this guy is back because I have a bunch of questions for him about this case. So I remembered that. And that was one of the things that eventually made me want to go back to private practice was, okay, I've seen a lot of good and bad, you know, effective and not effective lawyering. I missed it. And I think, you know, your other guests have talked about appellate lawyers. Our main function is to talk to judges. And, you know, that's a lot what career law clerks do. And that's something that I've always enjoyed doing is not necessarily pulling the wool over somebody's eyes, because that's not nearly as satisfying as having a honest discussion about difficult issues, talking about what the law is or is not clear on, what that case does or does not say, and sort of reasoning together to come to an outcome that is in keeping with the jurisprudence of Texas, right? You don't really win if you kind of cheat to get there.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Anyway, well, it does make a lot of sense. I wish more lawyers would adopt that view, frankly, not so much in our practice area, but on some of the work product that I see day in, day out. I think most folks are cognizant, you know, of the need to not tarnish their reputation by overstepping or misrepresenting. Just still see it too often. But I think you're right, Rachel. I think, you know, we are seeing an increased emphasis on written work product in the law. And I think even the time that we've had for the last year, you know, being in a pandemic is, this might be debatable, but I think it's made it even more important because you're oral presentation, you know, you're lacking some of the communication keys that you would ordinarily have, you know, subtle body language and posture and so forth, that you can really only capture so much on a Zoom screen. So it seems to me, I've always thought that the written work product was just as important in trial courts as it is in appellate courts. You know, like I said, it might be subject to debate, but I'd sure like to hear the other side's argument.
Good work product can be so immensely helpful. You know, I'm thinking particularly in federal court when there would be a difficult, uncommon subject matter that would come up. And it often felt like as a law clerk that I was dropped into the middle of somebody's alphabet soup. You know, I knew the case. I'd been working on it. I'd seen it on my case tracking spreadsheet for months. But did I really feel like I got what was at issue? Even after I'd read thousands of pages sometimes, no. It was really interesting to see. I think lawyers are sometimes afraid to talk down to courts, right? Well, surely he gets what this is about. Maybe he doesn't. Or, you know, of course he or she does. The judge is amazing and brilliant and they're all, you know, great at their jobs. But an introductory sentence about this is a, you know, FERLA case. This is a Fair Labor Standards Act case, and don't drop me in the middle of an alphabet soup. Why don't you define the acronym once or twice? I mean, I don't need you to define Mr. Jones, plaintiff, but there are especially lawyers who specialize in unusual subject matter or highly technical subject matter. It is really helpful to people who are sort of coming at the case, and I haven't picked up my statute book in a while. Can you remind me of what that acronym is, maybe on the first page, or what's the basic premise that we're going to be talking about in your subject matter, the doctrine that, you know, go ahead and drop that case and the site so that everybody can be on the same page.
Interesting. Yeah, you know, we had Judge Costa on and he kind of talked about the same thing. You get an alphabet soup in very specialized industries in federal court. And he said, it's just, you know, we're generalist judges. And sure, maybe we've had this kind of case or that kind of case. But when it's just two paragraphs of, you know, acronym after acronym, we're lost in the weeds immediately because it's just not where we spend our time.
That rule is not just for specialized subject matters. You know, it works very well across the board in cases. One example is like motions to compel. And that was something that I know a lot of trial judges are coming up with various procedures and, you know, to try and cut down or at least streamline dealing with motions to compel. I think sometimes the bar is not thrilled by what they feel are like speed bumps before they can get to hearings on their motions to compel. Judge Hanks, at one point, a couple of other district court judges have instituted the discovery dispute letter, or and I know some state court judges have similar procedures where you have to sort of set it up in a page or two to the court to explain, here's what kind of case this is, right? Here's what I asked for. Here's why it's important. And here's what the response or objection was. And here's why that response or objection was insufficient. Instead of, here's my motion to compel, see attached exhibit A, clearly this is the worst thing anybody's ever seen, I'm totally outraged, and I'd like $50,000 in sanctions, please. You know, there are more effective ways to do that. It's hard, you know, and I'm saying that as somebody who has done that in that world. Again, I know that it's difficult, but I think it's a lot more effective for the courts. And that's sort of the background, I think, why judges are trying to figure out how do we get lawyers to do that? And these pre-motions to compel or these discovery dispute procedures, I think, are just trying to make it easier because I think as lawyers, we forget how we sound. That was really fascinating. Being a law clerk, I sat through, I'm going to say 20 different jury trials, and watching the jurors as they would watch the lawyers was really interesting to just sort of see their reactions as human beings to certain arguments, to certain events during trial, and to realize that we know this as lawyers cognitively, but to see it brought home that juries do not like it when lawyers come off as jerks, and neither do judges. And we are just we get used to the idea that this is an adversarial system and become a little adversarial ourselves. And it really diminishes the effectiveness of the argument. So not only don't drop somebody in the middle of alphabet soup, but take a deep breath and try and, before you convey your level of outrage, perhaps walk the reader through what has happened to get you to this level of outrage before just starting off, well, I'm really mad and opposing counsel is clearly a very bad person and this is just terrible.
Providing surety bonds for court-related matters is a very niche industry, and there are very few appeal bond specialists who are as experienced as Court Surety Bond Agency. Whether the client is a sophisticated entity or an individual involved in litigation for the first time, CSBA uses its more than 110 years of combined surety experience handling appeal bonds to provide first-class service to its clients. For more information, visit courtsurety.com. You know, the structure of that discovery letter, it's almost like a lot of us could stand to use that just as a model of, for our motion practice and legal writing generally, because you know, you mentioned how many civil cases Judge Hanks had filed. I mean, the courthouses are still very full, and in our present circumstances, that's not going to change anytime soon. We're going to be, you know, litigation is going to be very active for a long, long time trying to climb out of this pandemic hole. And so, you know, getting in to educate your judges as quickly as possible about the things they really need to know, it seems critical. That sort of formula that that discovery letter follows, you know, it seems like a good guideline.
I agree. It was interesting to hear, you know, because I would go to CLE sort of as an anonymous lawyer, because I had to get my numbers too, and hear people complain about, oh, these discovery procedures, or I can't believe Judge so-and-so is making me do that. And it was interesting because I don't know if you've ever been at like an amusement park or something where you've seen a rule on a sign, like keep your hands inside the moving car as it's going down the roller coaster. You're thinking, you know, for them to have made that rule, somebody must have done something really stupid, right? Don't drop water bottles on top of other people's heads. Well, that rule must have had a genesis somewhere. And the discovery procedures are the same way, or any procedure where the judge is, you feel like as the lawyer, the judge is putting these artificial limitations on your practice. You know what you're doing. You've been doing this for 20 years. You've won these cases. Who is this so-and-so to come in and come up with these cockamamie new rules that you're going to have to bill your client? And these judges know that. They were all practitioners. They are aware of and sensitive to the idea that, yeah, that's going to take another 3 or 4 hours maybe to sit down and write that letter. Because even though it's 2 pages, it's not easy to write with opposing counsel. So maybe there's a reason they did that, right? Rather than just drive the bar crazy, drive up fees for everybody. I think the concept of one, as everybody says, read the judge's procedures. They're all different. But some judge somewhere sat down and crafted those. And so they're pretty personally attached to them.
And they need to be reminded that this is the decision maker.
It's like walking into somebody's living room and insulting their curtains, right? Like,
put your ego aside for a minute and tailor your argument and your presentation to the needs and desires of not only the system, because you don't have half a day to go and argue a motion to compel. You have 30 minutes, maybe. You know, you've got to get right down to what the issue is and what the ruling is you're asking the court to make. And it seems sort of almost fundamental. You know, we talk about it in this setting, but you get out of the courthouse and listen to arguments. It seems like a lot of that need is really lost on a lot of people because they're really not focusing their arguments in trial courts, at least. I mean, appellate court's a little different situation, but it's all very interesting.
I wouldn't be as afraid to state the obvious. You know, this is a personal injury case. The medical records are important because I need to establish either my client's actual medical injuries and the diagnosis to give to my expert. I mean, really laying it out in a sentence like that. I think as lawyers, we're afraid to do that because one, we don't want to be wrong. And two, we don't want to seem to be talking down to the judge. But as fast as a lot of these judges are going and the number of cases that they're dealing with, I think sometimes it's incredibly helpful to do that.
I think that's a great point. It's one that as an appellate lawyer, sometimes you forget because you're used to just, here's a big thing of briefs and you've got the whole record so you can figure out everything that happened. But, you know, thinking more about a trial court where you've got to move a docket along, and especially in places like Austin and San Antonio, where the judge who's going to hear your motion may not know anything about the case and may never see anything after that day. And they get a Friday afternoon set of motions and say, hey, you're hearing this on Monday. I think that's really useful to have just kind of a real simple, you know, boom, boom, boom. Here's what it's really about kind of thing.
I do think it has an application on the appellate level because I think we've all read records where we thought, what are they talking about? Clearly everybody in the courtroom had an idea, maybe not the same idea, but clearly everybody had some concept of their own about the subject matter they were discussing. I have no idea what it was.
Yep.
And those moments where you're just, you know, it helps create a better appellate record, even if it's aside from the effectiveness at the trial level. From an appellate standpoint, it helps the appellate court and it helps the presentation on appeal to sort of nail down, okay, and your honor, just to be clear, we're talking about economic damages right now.
It makes me think a little bit about the statement of the case in an appellate brief, you know, what function that serves. And the statement of the case didn't quite go that far, but it does provide that little, you know, one page, half a page snapshot of the case so that the judges can look at that page and see, okay, this is what this case is about. And, you know, sort of set their mind to that right frame. So they know more or less, or at least have some expectation of what's coming. So, but no, it absolutely has an application in appellate practice, even aside from that. If you just start reading the cold record and you don't have any context, you know, how do you know where you should be spending your time? because you could spend a lot of time reading a, you know, 1 week trial transcript and have it be wasted. And we all know efficiency is one of the names of our game right now. I mean, we can't go back and recreate things or take as much time as the trial lawyers did, you know, learning the case. It just isn't possible. It seems like that kind of clarity, you know, being able to express thought, not only on the facts, but the law, with that kind of clarity so that you get the court up to speed ASAP, it just seems like a real skill and benefit that we just need to all keep in mind.
I think it, you know, I would be very interested to sit down and talk to people who have practiced at different points in time over the last 30 or 40 years, because I feel like the advent of the electronic clerk's record has changed appellate practice both inside and outside the courthouse. There's still a cost to creating records, but the ease with which you can transport a massive clerk's record on a thumb drive, as opposed to when I was a term clerk, and then even as a briefing, even as a chamber's attorney, you'd have to literally walk down to the file room, spin the drawers, check out your big red well, sign for it with your life, carry it back to your office. There was a physicality of interacting with that paper and knowing the motion that's really at issue at this appeal is about three quarters through this massive stack of paper that's bound on sitting on the left-hand side of my desk. I know exactly where it is. And that changes when you're dealing with these PDFs and the links. And on one hand, yes, it's so great. You don't have to carry around a briefcase just for the clerk's records anymore. It sort of focuses what you were saying, Todd, about the importance of helping the court find the page you're talking about, because they don't, you don't have your little favorite color sticky, right? I had different color stickies for different things and say, oh, that's the blue sticky. Okay, I got that. It's a different type of interacting with the information that makes it really key to hone in, not just the argument, but, and here's where it is in the record. So I know a couple of past guests and other people have talked about the concept that waiver or not having something in the record is sort of a hot button issue. I think there's a perception in the bar that law clerks or staff attorneys or judges love to find waiver, or at least used to, and can't wait to spring upon some poor unsuspecting practitioner, aha, but it wasn't adequately briefed, or you didn't put it in the record. Or I think, first of all, that comes from a perhaps either a misunderstanding or a mischaracterization of the relationship between judges and their staff attorneys and their law clerks, because ultimately it's their name at the bottom of the page and it's their name on the door. So I don't know very many law clerks or staff attorneys that would have had their job for very long if they'd been pulling procedural shortcuts that their bosses hadn't signed off on or didn't fully agree with. Yes, I'm sorry, I don't think that was adequately presented. So the end. But also, I think it's sometimes driven by how difficult the issues are to brief properly and discuss. And again, when you've been living with a case and it has become part of you, sometimes we don't do as good a job explaining what's going on as we think we do in the heat of battle. And so someone who comes back to a cold record, like we were talking about, is not going to know the exhibit you were talking about or the ruling you were talking about, even though everybody in the courtroom at the time thought that they knew what was going on.
I think that's what gives appellate lawyers an advantage when they're coming in, you know, as sort of the disinterested observer, is they're not down in the weeds like that. You know, we've had a few folks on who have done both trial work and appellate work, and they'll acknowledge that the skills are different. But if you're the guy or the gal who tried the case, worked the case up from start to finish and took it to trial, you have little fragments in your mind of things that you recall or you think you recall. And I mean, we're all human. We make mistakes and our recollection is not, you know, total recall. So I think because folks like us come in and our task is, all right, I'm looking at this cold record and I'm trying to discern what's important and what the court needs to know and really distill the issues down to something that can impact the outcome on appeal. That's much harder to do, I think, from the trial lawyer perspective, someone having been that deeply involved in the case. And so it's our semi-regular plug, Jody, I guess, for appellate practitioners in this podcast. But it's just, you know, there's another word for that. It's like the expert fault or something like that, where you learn so much about a subject matter that you think everyone else knows what you think they understand it the way you do. And it goes back to what you're saying, Rachel, about educating the judges. You know, even if they have read your brief, they're not necessarily going to understand the law as deeply as you do, or certainly not going to understand the facts as deeply as you do. And that's where I think our job really is critically important, because we are the oracles, I guess, to the appellate judges of this is what's important. And it ties back again to the notion of you've got to have credibility in what you say, because that can be, you know, to have an appellate judge be inclined to treat what you say with credibility and importance, you can't buy that. I mean, it's just something, and it also is something that takes an immense amount of time to work up to, because you don't come out of law school with that amount of credibility or experience.
One thing I tell young lawyers constantly, you know, I live in Houston, massive city, but when it comes to lawyers, this is a small town. Even for those of us who are first generation lawyers, everybody knows everybody, you know, I mean, and people talk. Lawyers love to gossip. And the only people who love to gossip more than lawyers might be judges, because they can't talk about anything. I mean, think about it. They're like in this weird silo. Being a judge or being a law clerk is a very weird job. You can't talk about the kind of stuff that most people are free to talk about in the grocery aisle with their neighbor. And so what do they talk about? They talk about lawyers. They talk about what you wear, what they talk about your writing, and they talk about who lied to them yesterday, right? I mean, it's kind of the unfortunate truth. So it is really hard to build up your credibility and your reputation over time. And it is so easy to lose it with one motion or one argument getting caught up in the heat of battle. And you need that good cop, bad cop of at least somebody at trial, even if they're not in a purely appellate role, of having somebody listen and think, now, is that what we meant to say? Could we say it again? Do we need to hit that question again to sort of rephrase it and bring, I think we covered it, but could we re-ask that question of that expert to sort of highlight the exact point we were trying to make one more time? That's invaluable to have that other set of ears or eyes looking at your exhibits or listening to the questions that you're asking and the answers you're eliciting, to make sure you're ticking off the things on your checklist that you need, so that when you get to your charge conference or you get to, you know, a sufficiency review at the Court of Appeals, somebody says there was no evidence of this element. Well, of course there was. Okay, where? That's an interesting conversation, right?
Yep, that's exactly right.
Agree, 100%. Well, you mentioned before we started recording that it tied into this a little bit earlier, the notion of being able to take a snapshot of what appellate practice was like at a given point in time. And I heard you say something that I thought was interesting and I want to explore a little bit with you, which is that now is a really exciting time to be an appellate practitioner. And I wanted to ask you just why you thought that.
So when I was, like I said, I didn't know anything about appellate practice when I was going through law school, but I found it fascinating. I knew people loved it. One thing that, you know, since I didn't go to school in Texas, I didn't know anything about jury charges. And so I started practicing the granulation, broad form shift had already happened by the time I arrived, but there was still a lot of talk about it. Now, that was a subject I love jury charges. That is just, I get really excited about jury charges. It's probably an issue that I need to seek help for.
You're among friends, Rachel.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We all do.
Ooh, it's a jury charge. Yes. But, you know, if you wanted to sort of research the various versions of the pattern jury charge, you had to have all the books, right? To compare one version to that next version and see what the changes were. And you had to find a red line. Now you can just do it yourself in 3 minutes. You go to the old, you know, there's free old PDFs of another big thing I love is unusual sources of research. And I've got to plug the University of North Texas. They have a portal that publishes old governmental publications. So they have all of the old out of print pattern jury charge books.
Really?
It is so much
online?
Fun. Online. Wow. In PDF form. How great is that?
That's fantastic. That is good.
Right? I mean, I'm sure there are people probably laughing when they hear how excited we are about this, but I mean, it is truly marvelous to have this kind of access to documents, to be able to redline things, to be able to highlight and circle. I'm a huge proponent. I know, you know, I heard Mark Trachtenberg's interview and completely agree the importance of mixing the visual medium with written advocacy. One thing I highly suggest people do is if you're talking about a contract or an insurance policy, don't retype the clause. Do a screenshot and insert. So the actual font and the bolding and, you know, bolded as an original. Why not just use a picture of the original? It's so much more persuasive because you have to remember that as much as credibility matters and as much as we all strive for credibility, there are misstatements that get made occasionally, either intentionally or unintentionally. Judges don't trust everything they read because I think they've been burned too many times. So saying, look, you don't have to take my word for it that this is what the exception to the exclusion says. Here it is right here, cut and paste, same font, same weird courier, 9.5, you know, expanded so you can absolutely read it. Maybe you'll retype it in a footnote for legibility, but show them that you're not messing with the words. I wish we could do that for cases in a certain way. I mean, I don't know how effective that would be, but to say, you know, that was sort of the advent of the whole cleaned up parenthetical and how it was controversial about, are you really capturing all the edits? I think at the heart of that discussion is an important acknowledgement that it is really difficult sometimes to summarize accurately. We all strive to do it, but the nature of language is sometimes more imprecise than we want it to be. And there is nothing better than a cut and paste of the exact image of the thing that you are talking about in the middle of your brief used effectively. I get very excited about little things like that. The ability to have electronic clerk's records, right? To be able to word search, you know, I mean, that's just, I know, it sounds like we were all chiseling stone tablets back in the day, but it was not that long ago where things like that were not possible.
You're absolutely right, though. The word search thing is so nice to just be able to type in a term that's an important term, and then you can go through 10 volumes of the clerk's record in 10 minutes, as opposed to literally, you know, page by page, as we did back in the Stone Age, like you said.
Right.
Oh, I remember.
It's not perfect.
Mm-mm.
It's not. It does add that layer of efficiency. And I recall being a young lawyer in the later 90s, and it was not possible to word search a record. And so you think about the human effort that has to take place to be able to say that there's no evidence of something or some word doesn't appear anywhere in the record. Well, I was fortunate in that, you know, I was starting to kind of catch on that maybe we could apply some technology to this. And we had systems at the firm that I was practicing with at the time where we could actually scan and make things searchable, but you had to have special access to get the software. And so things that we take for granted now were just took superhuman effort back in the day. And of course, you know, you expect that there would be some efficiencies that would come along with the advantages that we have technologically, you know, greater demands from clients and so forth. But I totally agree with the notion that it is exciting. Speaking as someone who has practiced in different settings, you know, as a sole practitioner, I felt like the technology really gave me, it at least helped level the playing field. It didn't necessarily give me a leg up, but I felt comfortable, you know, going against firms of any size because I knew that I had the same information available to me that as they did. And so that's a great point.
Again, there's no substitute. It doesn't do away with the need for advocacy because drowning the court just in a bigger record cannot be a substitute for either preservation below or advocacy at the appellate level of not just saying, here it is in the record, but the overall landscape of why this is important and talking about the legal issues. That's, you know, you can't just say, well, it's in there somewhere, Fifth Circuit, I'm sure you'll find it. That is still not going to work.
As we're kind of getting towards the end, I was just curious if you had thoughts on oral advocacy, because you kind of saw it on both ways. You saw it at the Court of Appeals, where you have a very abbreviated, you know, here's your 20 minutes, get to the point. And then you also saw it where you're trying to persuade the fact finder. Anything that you take away from that that you wanted to share on that topic?
A lot has been said, and I think it's a fascinating subject. I think the assumption of good faith, both on the side of opposing counsel and the judge, is a good recommendation. When you walk into a hearing or when you walk into oral argument, you need to give everyone the benefit of the doubt. It's not trial by combat. You know, your client and the legal issues are incredibly important. But I think a lot of judges and I learn better or will have a more effective experience during your oral presentation if you assume that they're listening in good faith, that the questions really do have a point. I saw sometimes advocates get irritated or, you know, well, that's not what I'm talking about right now, Your Honor.
Well, if the judge asked about it, maybe the judge thinks it's important.
And just sort of being aware of that. You know, if opposing counsel spent their time and their client's money to work up an issue, even if you disagree with it, take a second to acknowledge it, address it, and explain why it's not important, and then move on. But don't just pretend it never happened because it doesn't fit within your framework of how you think this case should proceed. That would be something that I would sort of add to the overall body of great appellate and trial level advocacy tips that I've seen going around, is to go ahead and assume that the questions and the opposing counsel's arguments are, they may be incorrect, but they're at least met in good faith.
Well, we are winding down at this point. We've reached the point where we need to respect your time. You've been very generous with your time today, Rachel. I really enjoyed hearing your viewpoints on these things. So thank you so much for agreeing to come on the show and talk with us about this. The idea of, you know, what you need to do to sort of build and maintain credibility as an appellate practitioner just can't be emphasized enough. And I think we've covered several topics there today that will be valuable to our listeners. But we generally like it toward the end of our conversations to ask our guests for a tip or a war story if they care to share one. So we want to give you the opportunity to do that. And you've got, I'm sure, a lot of fodder from your time working for Judge Hanks that you could consider. So what do you think?
There's a lot that I thought about and said, no, probably no, not that one either. So here's what I feel is probably the most universally helpful tip from a former federal law clerk. And a lot of people know this, but I'm always surprised by the number of people that don't. When we go back to being in the courthouse on a regular basis, I would like all practitioners to keep in mind that the federal courthouses are mic'd. You are always on a hot mic. Always, always, always. Please assume that everywhere except the restrooms, everybody can hear everything that you are saying. And the same is true when you are calling in for a telephone conference. It is not uncommon for judges to be holding telephone conferences with this, the audio being piped into the chamber's audio. So the law clerks, the staff, people are making copies and doing their office work while listening to the hearings that the judge is having on the telephone. And maybe the judge is in the courtroom and the courtroom's empty. Maybe the courtroom's not empty and the judge is having 10 other hearings that day. I heard a lot about people's vacation plans when they were on hold, whose kid was in the school play, just a lot of chit chat. And it was all, most of it was just people talking and it was fine. And we just sort of turned the volume down until it was time for the hearing to start. But sometimes I think people might have chosen their topics of discussion or their phrasing slightly differently if they'd known that their conversation was being mic'd in to, you know, 50 different people while they were waiting for some sort of other docket matter. And they had an entire federal courtroom listening to there are stories about fly fishing in Montana. And
you know, that's a great tip.
That is a great tip. And that's one that, you know, doesn't really occur to me. So I'm glad you bring that up.
Yeah. And I think the same is true in the state court, appellate court courtrooms, and maybe even the trial courts. That maybe the rule of thumb ought to be, if you see a microphone, don't say anything you shouldn't.
That's right.
Just don't say anything at all, right? Like, yeah. You should always assume, just like on Zoom. I think this is great training for us, great reminders for when we go back in person. If you are anywhere near a courthouse or talking on the phone to a courthouse, you should assume that everybody can hear you and hear what you're saying. Not just the judge, literally everybody.
Well, that's a great place to wrap up.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.